Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. And now we're in depth on where all of the young feminists are in this political season.
Well, if fighting for women's health care and paid family leave and equal pay is playing the woman card, then deal me in.
If Hillary Clinton gets elected 7 weeks from now, it will be because women voters gave her a big boost. In a New York Times CBS poll last week, women, voters of color, and college graduates make up a strong coalition for her. But when you look at the ages of those women, an odd thing happens. Support among young women for the first woman who may be president drops sharply. The Times poll reports a 10% drop for Clinton among young voters, many of them women under 30. So why don't young women see Clinton's candidacy as a feminist milestone? And why don't many of those young women see themselves as feminists? This is something I'm going to talk about with Gloria Steinem next month when she's here for Talking Volumes, and something I'd like to hear from you today. If you're a woman under 35, I'd like to hear what feminism means to you. Is it something that you embrace or you shy away from? And for everyone listening this morning, and I'd like to hear from women first, does Clinton's candidacy say something important about the cause of feminism? So looking today to hear from young women among us, I want to hear about whether you embrace or shy away from the idea of feminism. And for everyone listening today, and hopefully women listeners first, does Clinton's candidacy say something important about the cause of feminism? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828, online, nprnews.org/live, on Twitter, where I'm hearing from a lot of you, and that's great, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Our guest today, Amy Richards, is the co-founder of the Third Wave Foundation. It's an organization for young feminists. She writes Ask Amy. It's an online advice column at feminist.com, and she's the author of Feminista, Young Women, Feminism, and the Future. And Amy, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Julie Zeilinger is with us. She writes a blog called fbomb.org, and the F stands for feminist. And she's the author of A Little F'd Up, Why Feminism is Not a Dirty Word. And she's with us today from New York City. And Julie, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show. Hey, Julie, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, good. Good. We can now. Good to have you on the show.
Great.
Thanks for being with us.
Excited to be here.
Amy, let's talk about the politics of this first. And this is not to say that if you consider yourself a feminist, then you have to support a woman candidate. And I know there was a little bit of controversy about that earlier in the year. But I'm puzzled as to why more young women don't see this moment as a cultural milestone, this moment of Hillary Clinton.
Well, I think there's a couple. I think the most important thing to name first is that young people in general, and this is historically true and it's definitely true today, feel disconnected from politics in general, organized politics. And you've consistently seen lowest voter turnout among younger demographics of people. And I think that that is something we see time and time again. We don't see a connection to the political process. So that's the sort of one disconnect. The other disconnect is this moment of Hillary. And the good news is that younger people have been raised with more feminism. They've been raised with stronger role models of both strong women in their lives and strong men unafraid to sort of talk about women's issues. Mm-hmm. And so the novelty of a Clinton first, a female first for president, is less novel for them than it is for us. You know, many of them grew up having Barack Obama, their first memory of a president. You know, that's very different from me, Richard Nixon. You know, so what feels like a first for us feels, you know, less nuanced, I think, for younger people. The bad news is that I think we're not as far along in feminism as we should be. And so I think it's naive to think that these, quote, symbolic roles of a first don't matter anymore. I still think they matter.
You know, I do want to come back to what you said first, which was that a lot of young women feel disconnected from the political process. And is part of that a perception that the political process is not the place where we're going to make gains in, you know, equal pay. For as much as President Obama talked about an issue like that, younger women think, you know, these gains are going to be made somewhere else. We don't need the political process to work for us on this.
Well, I think young people in general have an attitude, and I would put organized politics in the same, you know, it's a system and it's a structure and it's organized hierarchy. And I think there's a beauty that comes with youth, and often it's the ability to think outside of a box. And I think traditional politics looks like a box. And so we're very resistant to thinking that those traditional streams of power have as much relevance over our lives as alternative ways of thinking. And I embrace that optimism. You know, I think as you get older in life, you realize that everything we do comes back to politics. I mean, not absolutely everything, but many things we do, from, you know, the quality of our streets to the quality of our drinking water, as we saw in Flint, you know, to the quality of our teachers, has to do with traditional politics. And it comes down to that. And so being able to vote is our first moment of claiming that political power.
Julie, how does that sound to you?
Yeah, I completely agree with most of the things Amy is saying. I think that's really on point. And I think a lot of it comes down to disillusionment also. I mean, if you just take this past election as an example, it's felt like a media show and sort of a production rather than a real political debate. And it's been so much about the candidates' identities and how their policies affect our personal identities rather than actually making political gains. And I think I've seen a lot of my peers, you know, I'm 23, I work with teenagers through my job at MTV and through the F-bomb, and a lot of them just feel like there is no chance through this political process that's in place for the issues they care about to see the light of day. So I think it's that disillusionment with the existing system that we have, coupled with the fact that most teens today are on social media, and that is where they see a lot of really powerful activist efforts happening towards the political goals that they're interested in. Just for example, Black Lives Matter is one of the most impactful things I think my generation and the generation below me has seen. And it sort of speaks to where they are politically in a way that they feel they can relate to and also enter into. And I know there's been a lot of criticism about social media-based activism as sort of quote-unquote slacktivism, but I think it's the way in which young people feel they can be as politically engaged as possible, where they see this existing system and don't think that there's any room for them.
Abir says on Twitter, if your question is about young women supporting Clinton as a feminist milestone, it's because the reason we don't call ourselves feminists is because our feminism is intersectional. And to the phones, to Sade in Brooklyn. Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. I would like to contribute that Clinton has our support. Feminism is alive and well. And, you know, to shy away from that, I just don't see it. I think.
Yeah, go. I think your line dropped out, Sade. Are you still there?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead. You were adding.
Oh, so I said that the poll is incorrect. We support Clinton, and Clinton has the best interest of women, despite the fact that, you know, the media is portraying her to be otherwise.
Okay, I appreciate the call. Another listener here on Twitter says, Jody, perhaps they're more opposed to being labeled or generalized. Julie, do you think there's something to that?
Yeah, and I think one of the most interesting things I've seen, especially in relation to women and Clinton during this election, is something Amy was touching on before, and it's sort of this idea that this first woman president should mean something to young women in general. And I agree with Amy in that it actually is very impactful from a historical perspective that a lot of young people often don't acknowledge. But at the same time, I've talked to a lot of young people who say, I want to look at this candidate's politics and her policies and where she stands on the issues rather than just her gender. And as the commenter before said, you know, it's more important to us that we have a candidate that represents intersectional issues. And I think a lot of voters have taken issue with certain stances that Clinton has made on reproductive rights and especially the crime bill and sort of potentially racist policies in the past. So I think a lot of young people are trying to look at her as and this is sort of a very feminist standpoint in and of itself, look at her policies and how they actually affect women rather than her as a female candidate.
You know, Amy, I was wondering if the idea, the framing of feminists sounds like kind of a passé idea. And I was reading something that a professor of women's studies at Berkeley, Paola Bacchetta, was saying about this. She says that, you know, a lot of younger women believe that the pay discrimination and the workplace discrimination is an issue that they're just really not going to have to deal with. And then she adds, they get a rude awakening when they're in the workplace or when they see what the actual statistics are for women. I wonder if this is just age and a level of, you know, kind of work and life experience that creates some of the division here around feminism. What do you think?
I think there's always been two reasons people resist feminism. One is that they don't know what it means, and they think that feminism is asking them to be superhuman and do the, you know, go above and beyond and always speak up about injustice. And then the other misconception is that they know what feminism is. And feminism is work, and it does mean that we can't overlook the injustices that we confront. So there's sort of two reasons that I think people resist feminism. As to young people's lives, it's statistically true that younger people live equaler lives. I mean, we're in schools in equal numbers. On college campuses, women are actually the majority. We, in our first, you know, mediocrely paid jobs, we're both paid mediocre wages, males and females.
Yeah.
We both lack sort of work-family balance because family is, you know, we often, you know, we haven't had the onset of aging parents. We haven't often had the onset of child responsibilities of raising a family. And so it doesn't surprise me that younger people say, I don't feel unequal. Now, that said, obviously the highest rates of sexual assault are among women on college campuses and in high schools. We see reproductive injustice, as Julie was talking about. There are issues. And one thing you have to remember is that people don't want to feel less than. And so sometimes the resistance to acknowledging those differences is a disbelief of it internally. And so we want to override that by believing that it's true to be equal and that it's possible to be equal.
Right. Mara is tweeting here, speaking to something you said at first, Amy. She says, my daughter is a feminist, just different than my mom, worries about sexual assault, breastfeeding, flex time, not opening up career paths. Steph, off the page.
Jenna says, I'm a 28-year-old woman who is not voting for Clinton or Trump. I vote on policies, not gender, and I very much dislike being told who I should vote for. I also refuse to label myself feminist, even though I would agree with many feminist positions. Why? The feminist movement often demands blind support, and if you don't toe their line, it's implied that you are uninformed, uneducated, or have internalized misogyny. The feminist movement silences me more than the patriarchy they rail against.
So, Julie, I don't think that's true, but I know that that's a perception about the feminist movement. Do you hear that from some of your peers?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that might possibly be true in certain communities. I think there's also a danger in sort of hegemonically labeling the feminist movement overall. I think a lot of people subscribe to an idea that there are feminisms and there are a lot of different feminist communities and a lot of different ways of being a feminist. So I think it's really hard to put a sort of stereotypical blanket over this entire movement that not only encompasses gender, but as it becomes a more hopefully intersectional movement, the intersection of classism, racism, and trying to address all of these different identities, which takes a lot of shapes and forms. At the same time, though, I think my generation does have an interesting point when they critique feminism that historically it has been a really exclusionary movement and has focused mostly on privileged white women for the most part. And I think that the movement overall, especially in these different communities, is moving in a direction away from that, but it's also a valid criticism.
You know, Amy, I don't know if the real history and the experience of what Julie just said, that this was really about, that the feminist movement was really about white privileged women. This is something that the feminists who were activists in those days really pushed back against. Do you think that's true? That this was about white women and it was about middle class women and it didn't have a place for women of color in that day?
I think, you know, and there was a Virginia Slims poll that came out in 1972 or 73, and it looked at who identified with feminism, and women of color were more likely to identify as feminists. So at the, what you might call the heyday of feminism, women of color were present in greater numbers, at least in a self-identified way, than white women. And I think that that has, you know, continued to be true, in part just because I do think that when we get to the places that are labeled feminist, you know, who's in women's studies programs, who's subscribing to Ms. Magazine, who's maybe showing up at a Now meeting if they still have Now meetings, do tend to cater to a white experience, a white privileged, a white middle-class experience of feminism. But I don't think that that represents where feminism is in its entirety. I think when we look at who is executing feminism, who is really at the grassroots addressing the issues of fair labor practices, addressing the issues of the pink-collar ghetto, you know, it is predominantly women of color,
yeah,
and non-Ivy League-educated white women.
Julia, thought about that? Where feminism was and where it is today? You still believe it was the preserve, basically, of white middle-class women?
Oh, no, I don't believe it's that way today. I think that there, as Amy was saying, there's a perception, and in many spaces, in academia especially still, that it's a white privileged movement, and historically may have been more so. But the feminism I see today is incredibly intersectional. And I think a huge part of that is, since it's moved online into social media, I started my blog, The F-Bomb, almost 7 years ago now when I was a teenager. And even at that point, I remember from being a teenager, a white middle-class teenager in Ohio, I was open up to all of these incredible diverse perspectives because of blogs like Feministing and Juggling.
If you're tuned into the... I'm sorry, Amy, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say it was interesting because Julie and I both happened to go to Barnard College in New York City, and there was a piece in the New York Times over the weekend by the president of Barnard about plastic surgery and feminism, and it sort of talked about this feminist angst. And there was also an article about the officer, the female police officer, that has been accused of manslaughter.
The one in Tulsa?
In Tulsa.
Mm-hmm.
And none of the coverage of that was named feminist. The article about plastic surgery was named feminist.
Mm.
And to me, it's also what gets treated as feminist. And I think sometimes we go to the more trivial, I might call it, stories and label them feminist. And therefore, the experience gets repeated as a white experience. Whereas we don't talk about, you know, and Julie's referenced a couple times, Black Lives Matter, you know, the work that's happening in these communities that might not be exclusively about women, but is just as feminist. And so we have a responsibility as feminists to make sure that we're naming things as feminists that we would identify as feminists that maybe get, you know, misused as just life and pay inequity and racial inequity, but those are just as feminist as debating whether or not to have plastic surgery.
This is a conversation this morning, if you've just joined in, about how younger women and older women think about feminism and whether there's an intersection there between ideas, perceptions of feminism, and then where that fits into the culture and our culture of politics. And yeah, we're having this conversation on a day of the first presidential candidate debate. And I think some of the people that Hillary Clinton will be speaking to in that debate is rallying some young women. She is not seeing the numbers and the enthusiasm that Barack Obama does. So covering a lot of ground in this conversation. And I'd love to hear from you on this. If you're a woman under 35, I'd like to know what feminism means to you. Is it something that you embrace or you shy away from? What's your definition of what feminism means to you today? And then for all of us, does Clinton's candidacy say something important about the cause of feminism, or is the idea of that kind of passé? By the way, this is something, given that Gloria Steinem is going to be here for a Talking Volumes evening on October 6th, yes, we're sold out, but this is something that I'll be talking to her about as well, so be interesting to hear what she has to say about it. Today for you, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828 on Twitter at @CarrieMPR and Steph off the page.
Patty says it's a style issue with Hillary. Feminism has morphed from our mother's generation in the 80s, where women were trying to prove how tough they were and that they could stick in there with men. Now women don't want to change themselves or they're not out to prove their toughness. And Alexis says, I feel like feminism is an outdated term. Many white men have certain image in their head of a woman who doesn't shave and silly things like that. Feminism is so much more, but I think it's time to use different terms.
Would you read the first comment again, Steph? I'll get to the to the terms and the perception.
She says it's a style issue with Hillary and that feminism has more for our mother's generation in the 80s where women were trying to prove how tough they were, that they could stick in there with men. Now women don't want to change themselves and they're not out to prove toughness.
So Julie, what do you think of that?
I mean, I think that a lot of young women feel that feminism is sort of adaptable to their lives and feel that the movement can be changed based on where they're entering it. I don't think that there's this sort of monolithic understanding that feminism means either being tough in the workforce or sort of about what you appear like. I think that the movement of today is very much intersectional and discussing a lot of issues, and I think young women have loved that.
And Amy, your thoughts on that?
You know, there's always intergenerational tension, and so whatever feels like our mother's feminism, we're going to bristle at. I mean, that's been my experience. I'm laughing because I went to a fundraiser, True Confession for Hillary, last night in New York, and it was sponsored by Amy Poehler and other comedians, and it was called Laugh Your Pantsuit Off. And they really tried to reclaim the pantsuit in the moment of the evening, but there was nothing to both literally or figuratively make the pantsuit attractive. But I do think that feminism in another generation, there was, and this came both internally from feminism as well as I think the culture, that the way women had to prove themselves was to be as good as men. And I think the beauty of feminism today is that you can be a woman in a multiple, you know, definition of that term and be a feminist. And, you know, I use as an example that when women first ran the marathon, you know, they had to sort of sneak their way in 1967. And the first woman to run, Catherine Switzer, the Boston Marathon, finished in 4 hours and 20 minutes in 67. And in that year, the first man finished in 2 hours and 15 minutes. You jump ahead to 2016, and women's time is now under 2:20, and men is 2:12. So all of those years, women have gained more than 2 hours, and men have gained 3 minutes. And I think that it proves that the way we've approached feminism is that I just use that metaphorically, that we've had to prove that we can do what men can do. I think that now what we'll realize is that there's a beauty to being an individual and that should be the contribution that we make.
Yeah, Julie, just to say before we take another call, I'm seeing this on Twitter, too, from some of the young women that are listening who are forming groups at the University of Minnesota and doing a lot of great work. What bothers me a little bit about it is the perpetuation of this idea that there was one static definition of feminism, and it's what it looked like in 1972. Feminism, as with what Amy has just said, feminism has obviously evolved, but it's been, I think, politically advantageous for some people to stick that 1972 label onto it. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think it's actually been really interesting. I speak at colleges a lot and I've talked to a lot of students about this, and I have noticed what you're saying and sort of like these old stereotypes are sort of entrenched, and I think they're passed down, especially from parents or other family or community members, and coming from a community in Ohio that was kind of similar, that just sort of hang on to these stereotypes. But at the same time, I've also seen another kind of, in a way, problematically monolithic understanding of feminism based on the fact that just in the past few years, I mean, celebrities have been claiming the term. It's becoming popularized as well in the mainstream media. But at the same time, that's also a very limiting definition of what feminism is.
Yeah, good point.
And it's very much about girl power and empower yourself feminism without often getting into sort of the nitty-gritty details. So it has been interesting. On one hand, I totally see what you're saying. There is this sort of demonized stereotype
yes.
of feminism at the same time that there is this overly popular, not really critical understanding of it.
Yes.
And I think it's unfortunate on a lot of campuses. I
I think there are, to be fair, there are a lot of students who understand the middle ground and are pushing for that on their campuses.
Good.
But I do worry about this idea that feminism is this one stereotypical thing, whether negative or positive.
Michelle says on Twitter, I consider myself a feminist ally, but I resist a term history. She's speaking to kind of what we were just saying, that relies on the gender binary, a broader lens works best for me. And Studio Lorraine here says, if Beyonce is out and proud as a feminist, I think it's safe to say that it's a term that's okay with most. Okay, point taken on that. Michonne in Minneapolis. Hey, Michonne, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Doing good. Thanks for calling in. Tell me what you're thinking about.
So for me, feminism has been really hard in my workplace. I'm a young professional. I work in downtown Minneapolis. And I find that in meetings that are mostly run by men, any other women who are in the meeting, myself included, if we have a point, if we have something that we want to say, it doesn't come across the first time. We have to repeat each other's points in order for the men in our meetings to really hear us. And so I feel like we only find validity with each other. And in terms of the candidates, I just think that, I'll vote for her because she's sort of the only alternative at this point, but for me, Bernie was the real feminist. She was the one that she went to. She was really fighting for us. And Hillary's just kind of, she's a woman, which is great, but she doesn't really have the fire that Bernie had for feminism.
Hey, good to have your call. Amy, I'm going to come back to what she said about the workplace culture, this thing where, and you hear this from a lot of women, and this is, I think, the thing that some of the columnists say is, if you think it's all equality, wait till you actually, get deeper into your career. The thing where you sit in meetings and a woman comes up with an idea. This isn't just storytelling. This really does happen. And Michonne is kind of seeing that in action.
Well, and I think it's sad that I'm going to call it progress, that at least when she says it enough times, it can get heard.
Yeah.
Because what is I've also heard traditionally happens is that it only gets heard when a man says it.
Yeah.
That you'll say the same idea and then it'll get repeated. And I do, I'm very lucky to work for myself and I'm very lucky to work in settings that I mostly have control over and I'm working with other feminist-minded people. I also, I got on a plane the other day and the guy in front of me stood up and told me in the whole row about his great book that he wrote. And I thought if a woman ever took the time and the audacity to stand up and start talking about his book on an airplane, we would be as labeled as Hillary Clinton is.
Well, maybe more women should.
Yeah. No, yeah. I almost thought, I wish I had manifesto in my pocket. I could get up Julie's book and say, buy this one. and I do think that and Gloria Steinem, when she's in Minneapolis, we'll probably talk about this, that we still have a hard time with women in power because for most of us, the most powerful women in our lives has been our mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we hear a powerful woman, we hear a mother, which is often a nagging voice and a person telling us to do something. And I laugh because both Siri, who I fight with all the time because she never hears me correctly, and the person who gives me directions from my GPS is always yelling, you've gone off track, turn right. And I do think that we and those are middle-aged women's voices.
That's pretty interesting. I've never thought about that.
Huh. So we don't have, I think, a full range of what powerful women is. And so women don't know how to speak up. And more so, we don't know how to hear women when they do speak up.
Rose in St. Cloud says, age 30, I do feel that I'm a feminist. My version is more of a lifestyle than a movement. It embraces all parts of my life, including my race, my work, my class. And to Kayla in Sioux Falls. Hi, Kayla. Thanks so much for waiting. Hi.
Hi.
Tell me what you're thinking about.
Well, I do feel that the term feminism scares a lot of people, especially men. I have worked in the military, and when you say you're a feminist, they think that women are asking for special treatment as opposed to trying to help them understand that there is a gap. And I always joke and tell folks, hey, I wasn't a feminist until I joined the military. I didn't know. I didn't see. I thought women were equal. I didn't really understand what feminism meant or even oppression until I went in the military and I worked in special operations. I was treated horribly just because I was a female. And it was pointed. And the comments they said, oh, you're weak or you're falling behind, which were never true, were always because, well, you're the girl here.
You know what I'm curious about with this, Kayla? Was most of that treatment that you're talking about from some of the older generation men in the military, and you saw a difference, you know, more among your male peers or not?
You know, it's amazing. When I was in training, no. The instructors were the older generation. Yes, there were some that caused problems for me, but it was mostly my own peers, my own age group. The fellows that were going through training with me, they just decided, I don't know if it was a mutual decision. Did they talk about it? I don't know how it worked. But it would be, well, she's not doing as well as everyone else. Well, that's not true. I'm actually doing better than you academically in the schooling. And physically, I've never asked for help. I keep up and I carry all my own gear. I mean, it was these simple little situations,
right,
where we would go diving and they'd be like, oh, see, she can't carry her own gear. But I just did. You just watched me unload my tanks and put everything on the boat. I don't know what you're talking about.
It sounds demoralizing. Are you still in the military or are you out?
No, after 8 years, I actually decided I'd had enough.
Yeah.
Because and that was part of it. Psychologically, I could not take it anymore. Every unit I went to, everywhere I was stationed, there was this, and it was a huge contrast in treatment. They would actually not give me credit for the work I was doing and treat me harshly and say, oh, we're going to give you the desk job instead of put you out in the field. But then on the other side of it, they would continually be trying to be in my company and be around me and say some pretty horrible things about me. So it was this really hard thing for me to deal with and cope with emotionally and physically that I said, you know what, I can't do this anymore. I have to get out of the military.
Boy, Julie, it sounds like the military is changing yet more slowly than some of the other areas that we're talking about.
Yeah, and I'm so sorry to hear you had that experience. I can't speak personally to the military, although I know from Kristen Gillibrand's work and some documentary work, there's a huge sexual assault problem in the military as well. But what that comment really raises to me is a lot of women I know, and especially young women who, as Amy was saying before, often grow up in these situations of relative equality, often really don't come to feminism or sort of understand the validity of the movement until they experience this discrimination themselves. And as Amy was saying before, and as you were discussing in the workplace, I'm a little over a year out of college, and I've seen a lot of my friends who were once resistant to the term feminist and didn't think it was relevant in their lives start to claim it once they realize, oh, I actually do make less than my male coworkers who are doing the same work. Or as this caller was saying, you know, I'm doing the same work. I'm trying to say the same things that are equally as valid, but I'm not being heard. I'm not being given credit. And it's that sort of experience of quote unquote everyday sexism or it's not really subtle, but like subtle sort of more in the weeds things that really allow young women and well, women of any generation really to understand, you know, this really like, we can talk about this on a macro level of sexism and racism, but it has an individual effect, and that's sort of when they come to it.
Julie Zeilinger is one of our guests, joining us in this conversation about feminism in culture, in politics. It's been something I've been thinking a lot about because we have Gloria Steinem coming in at the beginning of the month. It's something I think about all the time, but I will be talking about with Gloria Steinem at the beginning of October. Julie writes a blog called fbomb.org. The F stands for feminist, and she's the author of A Little F'd Up, Why Feminism is Not a Dirty Word. And Amy Richards is co-founder of the Third Wave Foundation. It's an organization for young feminists. Her book is called Manifesta, Young Women, Feminism, and the Future. And she doesn't stand up on planes and tell everybody that they ought to buy and read it, but maybe you should, Amy. If you're getting a busy signal as you try to call in, call us back. I really want to hear from you this morning. Love hearing from all of these women in your 20s and your 30s. Also want to hear your experience with this if you come at feminism from a different perspective at a different age. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828.
on Twitter, where Kari says, 29, feminist, Hillary fan. Feminism means a lot to me, but a big part is still achieving autonomy from men making choices for us. And step off the page.
Ruth says, I find that millennial feminism is developing in collaboration with male allies. It emphasizes equality, not dominance. And Nina says, I'm a 49-year-old woman, generally considered to be a successful leader and entrepreneur. I push back against the feminist label because I feel it diminishes my own abilities and achievements. I want myself and my company to be recognized for ourselves, not because we're women.
All right. So the conversation continues on the other side of news. And here's something that I want you to think about. Is there a perception out there that feminism got it done, that the work of the way we think about feminism is finished, that there's not a lot of urgency around it? I'll ask Julie and Amy about that. I'd like your thoughts as well on the other side of news. Phil, what are you watching this hour?
Hello, Carrie. The first showdown between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump is at Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York tonight, and a record number of TV viewers is expected to watch. Clinton is banking on voters seeing her as a steady hand who can build on a record of President Obama. Trump has tapped into deep anxieties among some Americans, especially white Americans, and those who are working class voters who feel left behind in a changing economy and diversifying nation. Houston police say six people were shot and wounded at a strip mall in the city's southwest, and officers shot and killed the gunman. Police say there are no other suspects. The shooting comes just days after a shooting at a Washington State mall that left five people dead. And on 2 weeks ago, a 20-year-old man stabbed 10 people at a St. Cloud, Minnesota mall before being shot to death by an off-duty police officer. Some protesters say they will attend a Charlotte, North Carolina city council meeting and call for the resignation of the mayor and police chief after the shooting of a black man by a black police officer last week. They told a TV station they will attend the meeting this evening. The protesters say they are unhappy with how Mayor Jennifer Roberts and Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Chief Kerr Putney have handled the investigation of the shooting of Keith Scott on September 20th. Police say Scott was a threat and refused to drop a gun despite repeated commands. Family members have said Scott did not have a gun. And stocks are falling this morning and following the Asian and European indices into lower territory. Banks and technology companies are taking the biggest losses. Energy companies rose as the price of oil jumped 2%. More news ahead on NPR News. It's now 9:43.
Hi, I'm Chris Farrow. Join me for the next Conversations on the Creative Economy on September 29th with Ravi Norman of Thor Construction about how technological advances are changing industry practices. Get your tickets now by going to nprnews.org/creative economy.
Last Wednesday, I was with Carl Hiaasen for Talking Volumes at the Fitzgerald Theater. You'll hear that show on Wednesday of this week. And Wednesday night, I'll be at the Westminster Town Hall Forum with Jeffrey Toobin. He's got a new book out about the kidnapping of Patricia Hearst. We're going to talk politics, too. You'll hear that show on NPR News Presents as well. So lots of special events going on in the evening. If you don't have a ticket, you can always hear it on the air here at NPR News.
Support for this program comes from the Level 1 Pediatric Trauma Center at HCMC, offering a comprehensive array of life-saving resources. When your everything needs everything, turn to HCMC. More at hcmc.org/pediatric trauma.
Back to the conversation this hour as we talk about feminism, what it is today, what it was, where it intersects, who's interested in it. I could go on. Amy Richards with us, Julie Zeilinger with us this morning. And Julie and Amy, I want to go right to a call here from Sarah, who it sounds like has had an experience in her own life that mirrors a lot of what we're talking about. Hi, Sarah. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Tell me about this conversation you were having with your mom.
Oh, yeah. I turned 18 right before President Obama's first election, and she said, "Now you know you're going to be old enough to vote, and you know you need to know to just always vote for the woman. You've got to vote for the woman." She's like, "We've been working really hard, and it's not equal yet. So that's what you ought to do."
And tell me how you heard that, and what you did about that.
Well, I do keep it in mind. And if I don't have an opportunity to think about an educated vote, that's usually what I pick. But my roommate and I were just having a conversation about the election. And she had said, you know, I want to vote on their platform. I don't want to vote for Hillary just because she's a woman. So it just, it does really mirror some of the conversation that we've had.
Really good to have your call. Thanks very much. You know, Amy, so what Sarah just said reminds me of all the flack that Madeleine Albright got, who supports Clinton when she said there's a special place in hell for women who don't help each other. I want to hear what you think about something that Washington Post columnist Kathleen Parker wrote about that. She said, what's obvious if bittersweet is that Gloria Steinem and Madeleine Albright and possibly Clinton by association have passed the baton without realizing it. Through their temerity and hard work, they've created a world in which their original purposes have become obsolete through acceptance. So is that what happened in your view, Amy?
You know, first of all, I heard Madeleine Albright say that same quote 30 years ago.
Did you?
And was so inspired by it. And she sort of came to that quote when she was the U.S. representative to the U.N. and made a pact with the other female heads of state, and I think there were seven total, that they would always return each other's phone calls and be there to support each other, even though they didn't always agree politically, that they would be there to support each other. Jump ahead to last week. I actually passed Madeleine Albright in the halls of a conference happening, and I was on my way to a panel with Ellen Sirleaf Johnson, who's one of the only female heads of state.
The president of not
Liberia,
Rwanda.
Liberia. Right. And she said, you know, to the last caller's point, it is important to elect women, but it's more important to support women when they get in office. And this is, I think, a theme that we've heard throughout it, the women in the workplace, the women in the military, that when women get into these positions, we don't support them. So getting there is one of the battles. Supporting them when they're there is the other battle. And I think, so that's just, I think we, electing is important, but supporting is even more crucial.
And tell me what you mean by where you see the lack of support.
The lack of support, I think, is that we tend to be more critical on women.
Okay.
And I think there's a very real, if one man fails, he fails. You know, the head of Enron, he failed at that.
Yeah.
You know, if a woman fails, all women fail. And that's why so many women, and studies have proved this, are scared to take on some leadership positions because they don't want it to reflect negatively on all women. I think there's another sort of theme throughout this conversation, which is that there's a quality in the numbers and a quality on paper, and there's a quality in terms of a quality of life.
Right.
And I think that, you know, Russia is the big example to me that, you know, Russia on paper looks pretty equal. You know, minus the sort of, top echelons of power. They have, you know, graduation rates. They have, you know, access, you know, rates that are very comparable. In terms of quality of life, they have one of the highest rates of violence against women. They have one of the biggest gaps between male and female life expectancy. They have, you know, on average, women have 9 abortions because they have such, you know, they don't pass on good reproductive health care generation after generation.
Wow.
And so it just proves to me that this is a two-pronged battle, that yes, we have to go after the numbers, but we also have to be focusing on what is the quality of life and how do we symbolize that, and that doesn't come from the top. That comes from the bottom. That comes the choices that we make in our own lives and what we reflect out. You know, do we pay our babysitters a living wage? You know, do we make an effort to sort of promote women in our midst? Do I, as a white woman, give up my place on a panel so I can make sure that feminism is speaking to all women? You know, what are the things that we can do incrementally that will send a big message, you know, collectively that we're ready for a culture shift?
Call here from Kelly in Mankato. Hey, Kelly, thanks so much for waiting. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure. What are you thinking about?
Well, I guess my thing about Hillary is I am an out trans woman and I'm also an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily feel like my feminism as like a queer rad femme is the same as Hillary's feminism. Like my issue is me and a lot of my other young professional friends are really struggling with just being able to find a place to go to the bathroom at work,
mm-hmm.
and to be taken seriously in interviews and not be discriminated against. And I don't necessarily feel like those really fundamental problems are reflected in mainstream feminism.
So Kelly, stay with me for a minute, because Julie, I think this is something that you were speaking to. And I think what I'm hearing from some of our listeners on Twitter and now from Kelly, too, is that feminism has to be nimble and malleable. I think our listeners are saying it is, but we don't see that well reflected when we think about what feminism is. And I'd like your view on that.
Yeah, no, and I think this, it speaks to sort of the point I was making before about the modern feminist movement sort of being this monolithic girl power empowerment type feminism that takes a really positive lens on the movement and is valuable in some ways, but often I don't think reflects sort of these more individual intersectional issues. And I think that people are doing incredible work on these issues. Like, there are definitely movements surrounding them, but I think in sort of the popular mainstream movement, that's often not reflected, but it doesn't mean that the work isn't happening. And I think, just to bring it back to the election as well, I think Hillary Clinton has faced a lot of criticism for her individual stances on a lot of these more intersectional issues.
Yeah.
And I think that's all valid criticism. I would also pose to people that they should then be paying a lot of attention to local elections and Senate elections as well, because that's sort of where a lot of those, especially with like bathroom bills, that's where a lot of those legislative decisions are made. So I think it's about not, and again, I think Clinton deserves, any candidate running for president deserves criticism on issues like that are important and impact people's everyday lives. But I think we also need to complicate the conversation about who our elected officials are and how much we're paying attention to that.
Kelly, Julie just brought up something that I was going to come back to you on, which is this idea that, you know, progress on feminism, it can't be at the 30,000 foot level either, right? And the people that you're electing in Mankato or to the state legislature can make a key difference on some of the issues that you brought up as well. I mean, how much awareness is there of that among you and your friends and the people that are activists on this?
I mean, I think there's definite understanding. I work on the Mankato Pride Council, and it's something we talk about. I feel like there's kind of a viewpoint that addressing some of these issues is political suicide. Like,
really?
There's no way to get elected as a mainstream candidate if you embrace these so-called deviant lifestyles. And it kind of takes it back to a point where it's like feminism is afraid to take on some of these issues because they're afraid more mainstream, frankly, white cis women are going to no longer want to be a part of that kind of movement.
That's really so. Amy, what do you think about what Kelly just said on that?
So I lost some of it because it was just breaking up on my end. But I think that the what has always drawn people to feminism is, I mean, there's two things. I've had this online advice column Ask Amy for now. I always say right after Al Gore created the internet, I created my online advice column.
Nice job.
And what I have found there is that very few people are coming directly to feminist.com. Most people are desperate. Most people are looking for resources, and they're often looking, they're working on issues that haven't yet hit the mainstream. And the place that holds them has often been feminism. You know, I think we've raised our consciousness as a nation around domestic violence and the severity of domestic violence. But, you know, 30 years ago, it was feminists housing people on their couches. You know, that's what the domestic violence movement looked like. And so I think that feminism continues to be a beleaguered place, you know, more or less, because it's holding the issues, you know, sex abuse, you know, elder care, that we as a society haven't yet taken on in a big way. And I always, you know, when I talk about my relationship with feminism, it's the issues that I care about and think about and debate about and the values by which I live my life. Yes, it's these sort of writ large things that I think about, but it's really these tangible things that each of us can do on a single day that defines us as feminist.
Maria says here on Twitter, feminism forced to aim at a moving target. Hillary plays by men's rules, is best at all she does, still not enough for some people. Steph, off the page.
Cassandra says, how would this conversation be different if Carly Fiorina was a Republican candidate? I know that, woman or not, there's no way I could have voted for her, and I don't feel like she would have been the same type of big first as Hillary is.
Okay, so I want to understand what she's saying, that we wouldn't be talking about feminism in the way that we are if it had been a Republican.
It's more of a thought experiment. Ah. If Carly Fiorina had been the first candidate, would we be talking about her candidacy as a feminist
through
first
the lens
in the
of feminism?
Way.
Yeah, Julie, what would you say to that?
I mean, I think it's possible she would try to frame it as a feminist movement or a feminist campaign, as we saw Sarah Palin sort of attempt to do, to use the word feminism to apply to that. But I think that, and I would hope that sort of the criticism of that would be sort of the criticism that people have actually posed to Clinton, in that gender is not enough. Identity politics is not enough. It does not matter to a lot of women whether or not the candidate they are supporting is a woman herself, so much as how her or his policies affect their daily lives as women, and how they speak to a more feminist agenda than that. So I would hope it would sort of, any criticism of her would be about her policies.
Andrea says on Twitter, the misunderstanding of feminism reflects the reality that most folks learn about feminism from patriarchal mass media. And then she says, bell hooks, and to the phones to Selena in Minneapolis. Hey, Selena. Hi.
Hi, Carrie.
Hey, thanks for waiting.
Yeah, I think there's still a lot of progress yet to be made in feminism, and possibly the younger female voters just haven't had as much experience with it. I'm in my late 30s, and I know as I've gotten older and have more experience in my career, you see a lot more of that gender gap in the professional world. As you're going for manager or director positions, you see a lot more discrepancy in pay. You see women getting passed up for promotions, while men get them even though they have equal experience or performance. And then you get to, family planning. Maybe the younger voters just aren't there yet.
Right.
Well, maternity leave in the U.S. is very, very short compared to women in other countries. They get 6 months to a year. And I think, we just got to be patient, right? Because this movement is going to take some time. And I think that's Hillary's kind of looking at the longer shot. You've got to gradually make change over time, but continue working towards that equal treatment.
I really, Selena, I think you've got something here. And it reminds me of that conversation that we had with Kathleen Hall Jamieson last week, I think it was, about the double bind of leadership and what that double bind looks like today. And when you start realizing the double bind, somewhere in your 30s, deeper into your career, you start to kind of have this realization that it all hasn't been fixed, which goes to that question that I was asking as we went to the news break, is there this perception, Amy, that feminism got it done and there's really nothing left to fix? Not by what Selena says, not by what I think a lot of us have experienced.
I do think that, because one woman has succeeded, we think that we've maintained, progress, because we have a dozen, we have 14 women in the Senate, and we have, a number of women, Fortune 500 CEOs, and we have a number of women running media outlets. We think that there's more equality than there is. And there is incredible discrepancies, not only in the numbers, but I do think in the expectations. There was an earlier caller who said that she didn't want feminism to define her career because she felt like it undermined her career.
Right.
I never put in my bio that I'm a mother, because I do feel like the second you acknowledge that you're a mother, that there's an assumption that you won't work as hard.
Wow, Amy, really?
I still feel that there's the advantage is that then people soften to you because when you're a mother, you become more relatable if you're a feminist. That there's a relatability there, but I do think that there's still an assumption that you'll always be dragged away from your career. And I've always said that, I want women to be able to prove that they're just as good as men, but I more so want women to realize that they can be just as mediocre as men. And I still think that we as a culture suffer because we only appreciate women who are excellent, and we appreciate men who are good enough.
Amy, Julie, I hate to do this. I think we could go another hour with some really good conversation, but thank you very much for being with us. Really good, good discussion.
Thank you so much.
Hey, and sorry for everybody we couldn't get to. Please reach me on Twitter. I'm reading everything that you're tweeting. It's @CarrieMPR.